Welcome to Blue Dot, a look at our place in space. I'm Dave Schloem. If you live or visit the northern coast of California, you know it's one of the most beautiful places on the planet. With its ancient redwoods, gorgeous beaches, and towering mountains, it's also one of the most fascinating places anywhere when it comes to geology. The tectonic forces that have shaped this region make it one of the most seismically active places in North America, as three of the Earth's crustal plates, the Pacific, North American, and Tiny Gorda Plate, meet here, bounded by the San Andreas Fault, the Mendocino Fracture Zone, and the Cascadia Subduction Zone that's capable of generating a powerful tsunami as it did back in 1700. To learn more about the fascinating tectonics and seismicity of California's North Coast, we're joined by Lori Dengler. Dr. Dengler is a professor emeritus at Cal Poly Humboldt in the Department of Geology. She's also a superb public communicator who regularly writes a column titled Not My Fault in the local Times Standard newspaper, and she's also helped produce the pamphlet Living on Shaky Ground from Cal Poly Humboldt. It's a concise guide to what people need to know to stay safe in earthquake and tsunami country. She joins us now from her home in Humboldt County. Lori Dengler, welcome to Blue Dot.
Thank you for having me.
Well, I'd like to know a little bit about your origin story, about how you became interested in the earth sciences.
Well, I always like to say it began by having a crush on my geology 10 TA at Berkeley in 1965.
Ooh, that sounds interesting.
So I was a sophomore at Berkeley, and I was at that time a journalism major. So I was kind of up in the air, but I took my required science general education course, and I had heard, take Geology 10, which was the intro course for non-majors, you know, rocks for jocks kind of thing. And I was really fortunate because that particular fall semester, the person who was teaching it had been on the outs with the geology department at Berkeley, and he was being punished by teaching this Rocks for Jocks class. So he was a marvelous man, Howell Williams. He was a volcanologist.
Oh, I know who Howell Williams is.
He's, well, good. He's
fabulous. I have a vintage copy of his study of Crater Lake published by Carnegie.
Well, yes.
Oh, he's one of my all-time heroes.
No, you put your finger on it, because he was the one who really figured out the story of Crater Lake and the Cascades.
Yes.
And so this was his last year of teaching, and he had never taught the intro dummies geology course before. So he taught it the same way he would have taught his regular geology class. And there were 600 people in the class. And I'm sure that 580 of them were just bored out of their minds, couldn't understand anything. But I loved it. Howell Williams was a fascinating man, an identical twin. And he felt that to be a good geologist, you needed to be as much an artist or appreciation of the aesthetics of the scenery of what you were looking at, as well as all those scientific tools. So it was like, oh, this is really interesting, because never occurred to me to be a scientist. Fortunately, I had math was easy for me. I'd done four years in high school. I hadn't taken any math or science my freshman year. But it was like, oh, this is, you know, he would talk about Lake Titicaca as being the most beautiful lake in the world. And then he'd talk about his favorite mountains. And he'd talk about why he had no interest in being a petroleum geologist, because you didn't get to be in beautiful places.
Yes.
And he was just an unbelievable person. And even though there were 600 people in the class, I felt like he was lecturing to me. And then in addition, that class did have a lab. The lab instructor boy, he was a hunk. And it turned out he was also a good friend of my brother's, but I didn't know this at the time. And they kind of led me on. And so I had to come up with good questions to go into office hours. And as soon as you start asking questions, that's the best way to hook somebody on a subject. And so I long ago lost contact with that TA, but I continue to ask questions to this day. So the next semester, I thought, well, I'll dip my toe in. I'll take chemistry. I'll take calculus. And it turned out it was okay. I didn't love chemistry or calculus, but I could do it, and it made sense. And this was the dawn of the plate tectonics era. The very Yes. first papers had been published in the early 60s. And there was a raging debate going on in the geology department at Berkeley with roughly half the faculty that didn't believe it at all and the others that did. And so it was just a very, very exciting time. And I think the final thing that kind of clinched it for me, you know, I'd been taking these classes with 2,000 students, and I really hated it. I was one of two undergraduates in geophysics. My last 2 years of taking classes, I was often the only undergrad in a class, and there might be half a dozen to a dozen other students. I was treated like a graduate student. And it made all the difference. I could have stumbled into any other major at that time. In fact, I was thinking of becoming an art history major. Art history is actually not all that different in many ways than earth sciences, because you have to appreciate things in both time and in space. So,
and beautiful things.
And beautiful, and you really have to appreciate the aesthetics of how things are built mm-hmm. together. So that's just a kind of brief glimpse at my backstory.
And gosh, Howell Williams, you know, for you to, you know, how fortuitous is that? One of the world's greatest geologists of all time is your teacher. That's just amazing.
Well, it was wonderful because in 1980, I was able to spend a couple of weeks with a team of scientists studying Mount St. Helens just months after it had blown its top. And I definitely was channeling Howell Williams while I was there.
Oh, yeah, I can imagine. Well, you are at Humboldt, Cal Poly Humboldt, which is in one of the most tectonically fascinating places on the planet, in my opinion, and I think you probably think so too. How'd you get there?
Well, somewhat accidentally, my partner at that time, who is now my husband, he got a job on the North Coast. He got a job with Redwood National Park in 1976. So this was before the park expansion, and there was a lot of concern about how upstream logging was affecting the tall trees grove. And so he and another geomorphologist, PhD, were hired, kind of unusual because the Park Service didn't usually hire PhD scientists, to basically trot out on every proposed timber harvest plan and make a determination if that cut would affect the sedimentation rate in what was at that time considered the tallest tree in the world, the Tall Trees Grove. So he took that job, didn't like that job, lasted less than a year, because walking in these beautiful old growth forests and going, well, I think we can kill those and not those, turned out to be not exactly what he had in mind as a research fluvial geomorphologist. Was fortunate that he jumped into a position at the Redwood Sciences Lab in Arcata. And what you have to realize about the North Coast is we have more earth scientists per capita than just about any other place on Earth. whether they're dealing with environmental stuff, whether they're dealing with forestry, whether they're dealing with tectonic, they're just a lot of, and it's a group that tends to hang together. And in those days, the geology department at Humboldt was huge. We had close to 300 majors, undergraduate majors at that time. And my husband, Tom, got to know a lot of those folks. And there was always the sort of need to bring in another temporary faculty member to teach this huge slug of students. And so he managed to get a temporary teaching slot for me. And so, sure, I'll do that. I was finishing up my PhD at the time. And so that was, you know, my first experience teaching at Humboldt. Then I left for a year. I did a postdoc at Stanford, hated that, came back and managed to get another temporary position at Humboldt, which soon after was announced as a permanent position, and I fortunately got it. So I've pretty much been at Humboldt, well, continuously since the fall of 1979.
Okay, let's talk about the tectonic setting where you live, because it's fascinating. Most people are not aware that the north coast around Eureka, that area around Humboldt County, is one of the most seismically active places in North America. Tell us about the tectonic setting and why there are so many earthquakes there.
Well, there are a whole lot of large pieces of real estate moving in different directions. So one of the things that really excited me when I got into earth sciences back in the 1960s was this developing idea of plate tectonics, the idea that our planet has evolved a system to basically get rid of its heat by a relatively rigid outer shell, and relative is important, these sort of chunks and pieces of the eggshell, so to speak, that are able to move relative to one another, driven by heat and gravity. So basically heat causing things to rise, gravity pulling things down. And so we have this absolutely beautiful system of plates, these relatively rigid slabs that are continuously evolving. So the shape of the planet 100 million years ago looked very different than it did today. And 500 million years ago, more different still. And 100 million years from now, again, you won't recognize it because we're constantly in motion. And so the way the system is set up today, there's a very, very large plate. We call it the Pacific Plate. It's the largest of the 12 major plates on the planet, and then there are dozens of minor ones. It's sitting out there. Well, nothing's really sitting. But if you look at where we are, I'm sitting right now atop the North American plate. And perhaps most of you listening are also atop the North American plate. Now, if you're in Shelter Cove, which is also in California, you're actually on the Pacific plate because the division between the North American and the Pacific plate is that leading edge is the San Andreas Fault, which cuts off a little sliver of the California coast, a lot of the Southern California coast from North America. So nothing is static. Everyone has probably heard of the San Andreas Fault, which is one of the boundaries between the Pacific and North American plate. And today, that boundary is what we call a transform boundary, where the two sides are moving like cars on a British highway. So as I'm sitting in Humboldt County, if I were to, well, let me move myself down to Mendocino County in the world of the San Andreas, or let me not quite get to shore. I'm driving to Shelter Cove, and I'm about to cross that plate boundary. It's before I do, if I'm looking across at where Shelter Cove actually is, and I could speed up time, I would see the block that Shelter Cove and the whole Pacific Plate would be moving roughly to the north-northwest relative to where I would be sitting on the North American Plate. And back in 1906, when we had the great northern San Andreas earthquake, I don't like to call it San Francisco because
it was much bigger than that.
It was much, much bigger than that. So back in 1906, if I had been sitting there in my car about to cross the fault, I would have suddenly seen Shelter Cove, jump roughly 15 feet to the north.
To your right, as you looked out at
it. To my right. And hence, it's what I'm calling a right lateral strike slip fault.
And how fast would that motion be? Would it just be a blur? Would you be able to actually see it?
Had I been there at the time, if I'd been standing, it probably would have thrown me to the ground.
Yeah. But let's say you were hovering. You were like a drone.
If I were hovering, well, we've actually now got some footage of faults actually slipping. I mean, the actual speed with which that slip is occurring is on the order of a few miles per second.
That's fast.
That's really fast. So the rate of fault rupture is roughly the speed of a seismic S wave, the secondary wave. And it took the secondary wave from when it started, just about where the Golden, just offshore of the Golden Gate Bridge, it took roughly 2 minutes for that S wave to travel from that spot up to where I am now. So that would be a wonderful way to travel. If we could somehow attach ourselves to an S wave, it would be a whole lot easier than dealing with airports and a lot faster. But
yeah, that's a high speed aircraft.
We haven't figured out how to do that yet.
We're going to take a short break, but stay with us as we continue our conversation with Lori Dengler, geology professor emeritus at Cal Poly Humboldt, as we talk about the complex tectonics of California's North Coast that makes it one of the most seismically active and beautiful places on the planet. I'm Dave Shlom, and you are listening to Blue Dot. And we're back, and thanks for listening to Blue Dot. Let's continue now as we visit with Dr. Lori Dengler, geology professor emeritus at Cal Poly Humboldt. We're talking about the complex tectonic forces that have and continue to shape California's North Coast. And so the San Andreas, it ends near you, doesn't it?
It goes
from the Salton Sea, the Salton Trough down in very Southern California, Mexican border. Doesn't it kind of end near you?
It does end basically at what we call the Triple Junction at Cape Mendocino.
Mm-hmm.
So it's easy to sort of map out the trace of the San Andreas where it's on land in California because it's left a phenomenal scar. One of my favorite places to go in the spring is the Carrizo Plain, which is sort of east of San Luis Obispo. And there you just see this spectacular creases in the ground from repeated San Andreas earthquakes. So I'm going to put a little caveat here. In fifth grade, which is when they usually teach about plate tectonics, at least in California, they get across this idea that somehow the boundaries are these distinct lines and everything else, nothing much is happening. Well, the actual boundary between the North American and Pacific Plate certainly encompasses, we think the San Andreas is the western edge of it. Then you've got a whole bunch of additional faults that are part of the San Andreas system. So in the San Francisco Bay Area, we have the Calaveras Fault and the Hayward Fault and a whole bunch of others. As we go further south in the Los Angeles area, we have the San Jacinto, the Elsinore, and again, a whole bunch of somewhat parallel fault systems that also have that same kind of motion. When you get north of the San Francisco Bay Area, we have the Rogers Creek Fault, and then we have the Mayacama that cuts right through Willits. I always used to like taking field trips to show them the brand new cracks that had opened in the parking lot just opposite Safeway. It didn't matter when you went, if they had just tarred them over a few weeks before, you'd see the new cracks because that was part of a fault that was creeping
along.
Gets a lot more complicated as you get further north because, number one, we haven't had major historic earthquakes since there have been people writing notes. And there's a whole bunch of trees covering the ground. So we get to the Bartlett Springs Fault, and it's much harder to tell. There's probably other faults in that system that we've missed, but we have this zone. It's not just one single strand, but it's even more complicated because when you get to Eastern California and the Nevada border, there's a whole nother series of faults that are a little more complicated than the San Andreas, but also roughly have that right lateral motion. They're also part of the transform. And in fact, the entire basin and range stretching Eastern California, Nevada, Utah, that's again all part of this stretching of the Western fabric of the North American continent and all part of that transform fault system. So it's not just the San Andreas.
Yeah. Well, let's go back to the Mendocino Triple Junction.
Back to our area. So we are tectonics in transition. 20 million years from now, the San Andreas Fault will be extending certainly well into Oregon. Might be linking up with the Queen Charlotte Fault north of Vancouver Island. That's eventually what is going to happen. But in between Cape Mendocino and Vancouver Island, we have a little chunk of what was once a huge plate that covered the entire Eastern Pacific. We call it the Farallon Plate. 85 million years ago, the entire west coast of South America and North America was a huge subduction zone, very much like the Andes are today. And in fact, the Sierras are the remnant. They're the roots of the volcanoes that were part of that subduction zone system 150 million years ago. So what has been happening since then is that trench was swallowing up the Farallon Plate more rapidly than it was being generated at the ridge. So every year, the ridge got a little closer to the trench, got a little closer to the trench, got a little closer to the trench. Somewhere around 40 million years ago, that spreading center got to LA. And, you know, when you get to LA, your life has got to change. And what happened roughly 40 million years ago, give or take a few million years, is that the ridge hit the trench. Now, ridges are really weak. The slab that's going down, that's subducting, is strong, it's coherent, gravity's going to keep pulling it down, but it's not going to pull down the other side of the trench because there's no strength between those two. And so the other side, which is the Pacific Plate, it is basically stuck up against now the North American plate. But because the subduction was not purely perpendicular, it was at an angle. Once the two met, the San Andreas Fault was born. And it was tiny, teeny weeny when it started. A few miles, tens of miles, was just all in LA. But as time went on and more of that Farallon plate was subducted and more of the ridge hit the trench, the San Andreas Fault grew. So by about 12 million years ago, it was getting close to the San Francisco Bay Area. And by about 5 million years ago, it had made it up to the Clear Lake area. About a million or so years ago, the San Andreas Fault made it to where it is today, the Cape Mendocino area. Now, we can't measure it. It's not like incrementally moving each year. There's a debate. Does it kind of inch along heading to Oregon, or does it make big jumps? We don't know. Right now, we can't really tell the difference. But what we do know is that now we have what we call a triple junction at Cape Mendocino, where we have three major fault systems and three plates that are in contact. I actually think it's more useful to think of it in terms of the faults that are kind of coming together rather than the plates, because then the earthquake activity might make more sense. So to the south, we have the San Andreas that I've been talking about, where the Pacific plate is basically trying to push right into what we call the southern part of the Gorda plate, the last little remnant of this once huge Farallon plate. So the boundary between the Pacific plate and this, the Gorda or Gorda Juan de Fuca, that remnant of the Farallon, that's another transform fault. So basically the process is, well, it's driven by gravity. The fact that
it's dense and heavy and it's being pulled down.
The plate is heavier and it's just pulling. Now, if everything were nicely lubricated and well greased, it would just be sliding underneath me and I wouldn't notice it. But there's a lot of heavy real estate sitting on top and there's a lot of pressure that is holding the North American plate on the top of this descending Gorda Juan de Fuca plate. So right now, that movement, and we can measure it because it's actually causing the entire Cascade region to sort of compress and to bulge upward and to move slightly to the east-northeast. We can now measure that with very precise GPS instrumentation. And so eventually, the strength of that boundary won't be enough to resist that motion. And that's the point where it will rupture, boing, elastic rebound. And all the stuff on top that has been squeezed, including where I'm sitting, Portland, Seattle, all the way up, you know, Vancouver, all of that area, it will get a rupture. It may be a partial rupture, maybe only the southern part of the system. It'll rupture from Cape Mendocino to just north of the Oregon border. Maybe it'll be a full rupture, 650 plus miles all the way up to Vancouver Island, Canada. We don't know. We think it probably does both. But I will suddenly find myself being flung at least 20 feet, could be 60. 60 feet is probably more average. In some cases, even more than that, flung closer to Japan, to the west. So where I am right here in the heart of the Gorda Plate section, the Southern Cascadia section. We've got a lot of things going on. We have that Cascadia squeezing. We have that shove from the Pacific Plate, that, you know, the San Andreas Fault. But we've also got a shove from the north, because if you look at a Google Earth map, you can see the Mendocino Fault extending due west from Cape Mendocino.
Yeah, it's this like ridge you can see out there, the Mendocino Fracture Zone, right?
Well, no, we got to be careful, because the only fault part is about the first 160 miles between Cape Mendocino and the Gorda Ridge. That's where we actually have that strike slip movement, that transform movement going on. But this process has been going on for tens of millions, probably more than 100 million years. And it's created a scar that extends 3,000 miles into the Pacific that's now dead. There's no earthquakes. There's no current fault movement on what we call the fracture zone. Now, we have a very similar transform system extending off the southern Oregon coast. And we call it the Blanco Fault. So if you look at an earthquake map or a Google Earth map, you'll see this very odd bathymetry, seafloor shape off of the Northern California, Oregon, Washington coast. And it is the remnant of this once huge Farallon Plate. The chunk, the smaller chunk off of Northern California and Southern Oregon, we call the Gorda. Once you get into Oregon and Washington, it's a much bigger chunk. We call that the Juan de Fuca. And the Blanco Fault is very similar to the Mendocino Fault. It's a transform fault between the Pacific Plate and the Juan de Fuca Plate. We just had several pretty good-sized earthquakes, 5.9 a couple weeks ago. Every year, there's typically a couple of sixes on the Blanco Fault. Fortunately, they're so far offshore, they're barely felt. And we've never seen an earthquake larger than 6.3 on the Blanco. So its horizontal movement does not have a tsunami potential, very benign as far as humans are concerned. But the Blanco Fault, where we have the movement, the Juan de Fuca Plate is moving south-southeast relative to the Pacific Plate. That movement is actually putting the Gorda Plate in a vise, because the Blanco Fault is not parallel to the Mendocino Fault. And that's what really is driving all of these earthquakes that we have offshore in the Gorda Plate. We had one in 2013. We had one in 1980. We had one in 2010. I mean, we have earthquakes in the magnitude 6 to low 7 range, a couple every decade, that are in this Gorda Plate, because it's being squeezed by the Pacific Plate to the south and by the motion of the Juan de Fuca Plate to the north. So this region is unusual, because most of our earthquakes are not behaving themselves and being on the plate boundaries. They're actually within the Gorda Plate. The Gorda Plate is being broken up, and as it subducts, it carries those faults, those zones of weaknesses with it. And our last really major damaging earthquake occurred on December 20th, 2022, caused nearly $100 million worth of damage. Almost every structure in Rio Del was damaged. That was on a strike slip fault, but beneath, in the subducted plate beneath North America, because it had been carried, it had been that weakness zone had been subducted beneath us.
We're going to take a short break, but stay with us as we continue our conversation with Cal Poly Humboldt Professor Emeritus Lori Dengler as we discuss the seismic hazards of the Northern California coast. I'm Dave Shlom, and you are listening to Blue Dot. And we're back, and thanks for listening to Blue Dot. Let's continue now as we visit with Lori Dengler, Professor Emeritus at Cal Poly Humboldt. Dr. Dengler is one of the leading experts on the complex geology of the Northern California coast that makes it one of the most seismically active places in North America. I'm wondering if you could comment a bit on the tsunami warnings we've got just in the last year or so, like the July 29th Kamchatka event across the Pacific Ocean. We got tsunami warnings here. And December 5th, the earthquake that happened that I was recording here in the studio and felt here in Red Bluff, you know, quite a ways from you. Tell us about how those warnings worked and how the system has developed and what are the things that went well and what are the things that need to improve? Because that is definitely a threat to the North Coast all the way up into Canada.
Well, and actually the potential tsunami warning affected far more than just the North Coast, as people realized on December 5th, that warning went from essentially Santa Cruz to nearly to Central Oregon. So let me first explain the fundamental bottom line of a tsunami warning system is to alert people who are potentially at risk with enough time so they can get out of harm's way. And time is of the essence. The two events that we've had recently that I got alerts on my phone for, in both cases, sort of show us the two different endpoints of the tsunami warning system. December 5th was an earthquake that was located roughly 40 miles off of Cape Mendocino. And had it produced a tsunami, it did produce a tsunami. So it was not a false alarm. It did produce a tsunami. The first surges arrived on the nearest coastline about 20 minutes after the earthquake.
Well, that's interesting, because when a big subduction zone earthquake occurs and you do get a large tsunami, is that about the time warning you're going to get, about 20 minutes?
Probably not here in Humboldt County. We kind of use 10 minutes.
10 minutes, okay.
Because the actual deformation of the seafloor is happening closer to the coast than that earthquake on December 5th. So the leading edge of the subduction zone is roughly 45 miles off the coast here, but the entire seafloor from the coast to that point is actually deforming in the earthquake. So the result is that the source is not just the line at the edge, it's closer to us than that. And so, our general rule of thumb is plan for 10 minutes at best.
Take us through like what this would be like. Let's say, you know, there's a major rupture on the Cascadia subduction zone, and you're perhaps a tourist visiting, you know, Redwoods National Park, and you're right next to the coast, you're on the beach area. What would you feel? How long would it last? And then what should you do?
I'm going to actually go back to your earlier question, and then we'll quickly jump in with that one, because December 5th, strike slip fault did not produce a major tsunami. However, it could have triggered a landslide. And in those first few minutes, the tsunami warning centers get their initial bulletin out in the first 4 to 5 minutes. And pretty much the only info they have is the preliminary magnitude and the preliminary location. And so with the way our present system is, an ability to analyze quickly, as soon as an earthquake happens that's roughly about magnitude 7, and there's coastline 120 or 30 miles from it, you're going to get a warning. Very different situation on July 29th. Magnitude 8.8 could be very much the size of the next Great Cascadia earthquake. Huge earthquake, 400-mile-long rupture, ruptured for 3 minutes, and it was really strictly Russian territory that was close, the Northern Kuril Islands and the Kamchatka Peninsula. They issued a tsunami warning. The U.S. tsunami centers issued information to help foreign governments make that decision. And then the rest of the Pacific was initially put into a watch, means we're looking at it. Then as the tsunami passed over more and more instruments, it became pretty clear that this small section of the coast, northern Humboldt and all of Del Norte County, was going to see wave heights higher than 3 feet. And that's when the warning was declared from Cape Mendocino to the Oregon border. Those were two situations that are fairly easy to deal with because we're not dealing with shaking right here. A Cascadia earthquake is going to be a little bit more like being in the Northern Kuril Islands, being in Petropavlovsk, but a little bit worse if you're in Humboldt County, because that earthquake was pretty far off the coast. Most of the subduction zone there is well over 100 miles away from the coast. So there's a little more travel time than there is, for example, in most of Humboldt County, where we're really looking at less than 10 minutes, or about 10 minutes at the most. In northern Oregon and Washington, maybe 15 to 20 minutes is reasonable. But we're still talking about a really short time fuse. Not enough time for emergency officials to knock door to door and tell people that are in the tsunami zone that they need to evacuate. Not enough time to set up, you know, control traffic. In fact, the really big difference between that big earthquake here and one really far away is that the earthquake is going to do a lot of damage. The shaking is going to last 3 to 5 minutes.
And that's a long time.
Probably going to disrupt our infrastructure, number one. So my phone is going to be useless. No WEA alert.
Roads are going to be probably impassable.
Right. And we don't want people to drive anyway, because what we saw in Japan in 2011 was that roughly half the deaths were people in their cars.
Time to drive, yeah. So what should somebody do? Let's say I'm a tourist, I'm visiting, and the ground starts to shake. Take me through, you know, what it's going to be like, and what do I do?
Number one, if you live in California, Oregon, Washington, or any place that has a coastline, find out about your tsunami hazards. And all the coastal states now have some kind of tsunami hazard map. I don't live in a tsunami zone, so I need to worry about shaking, but I don't need to evacuate. It's just as important to stay put if there is not a threat. So I'm sitting here, and in the next minute, we'll say, okay, the Cascadia subduction zone decides to rupture. So possible I might get a shake alert, but only if the rupture might be starting in Washington or Oregon. If the rupture starts within 15, 20 miles of where I am, I'm going to feel the ground shaking before I get any alert. So I'm going to protect myself while the ground is shaking. And we always talk about drop, cover, and hold, but I like to put a little quotation about that because a lot of us really aren't capable of crawling under a desk. And it turns out if you just stay put and lean over, protect the back of your neck, and most importantly, reduce some of the hazards around you beforehand, you'll be fine just as long as you don't follow that instinct to bolt out the door. That's when you're going to get injured. So I like to count out the duration because it, for one thing, gives me something to focus on and calms me down. But on the other hand, it also gives me a sense of how big the earthquake is. If I count 20, 30 seconds, I'm talking about something that's a magnitude 6. If I count into the 40, 50 seconds, a magnitude 7. Once I get over a minute, I'm probably talking about something that's getting close to a magnitude 8 and certainly has the potential to produce a significant tsunami. If the shaking's over in 10 seconds, don't worry about it. It may shake like crazy, but it's over quickly. It's a small rupture. If it doesn't shake very hard, but I'm going on and on and on and on, that is the tsunami threat. So after the shaking, if I live in a tsunami zone and I know it, and I'm going, this thing lasts a really long time, as soon as I can safely move, I am going to grab my kids, march up to our pre-arranged evacuation site, and then I'm going to stay there.
How high up do you really need to get? Like, you know, to think about higher ground, how high up should you try to get to?
Well, it turns out that also depends on where you are. If you're on a ocean cliff face, you know, you might get splash as high as 100 feet. But if you're 2 miles inland from the coast, the tsunami is going to lose its energy. And that's why you need to look at the state maps. All of the states have prepared detailed maps for the worst case tsunami event. And you will find that it is a very intricate, it's not a ring around the bathtub. It is much lower in some places, higher in others. And that's what you need to use to guide you. Now, fortunately, most of the Pacific states have also posted entering and leaving tsunami hazard zones.
Yes, you see those signs all up and down the coast highway.
But please don't get in your car. Or if you get in your car, make sure you tell yourself, as soon as I'm stuck in traffic, I am getting out and knowing what to do.
Yeah, based on what we saw happening in Japan in 2011.
Absolutely, mm-hmm. Absolutely. We tend to think of our car as being safe. A car is not safe in a tsunami.
No. And why is it that, like Crescent City, for example, there's certain places along the coast that, you know, even when it's not a big tsunami, they really feel the effects in their harbors. Isn't that word actually mean harbor wave in Japanese?
Tsunami means it. Yeah, it's tsu and nami, which means harbor wave. Yeah. But it's a compound word that now means much more than that. Why is Crescent City a tsunami magnet? It turns out there's like 5 main reasons. And part of it has to do with the seafloor shape. The offshore bathymetry actually focuses energy on the Northern California coast. But Humboldt, we get focused just as much or even more than Del Norte County, but we're high in elevation. And Crescent City is sitting right there exposed. Then we have oscillations that get set up on the continental shelf. We have oscillations that get set up within the harbor. We have the shape of the offshore that tends to focus energy into the harbor. And then to add injury to insult, in the 1970s, when they built Citizens Dock, they built it in a way that would enhance the exposure to tsunamis. what happens is you get the water coming into the larger harbor, and then it's focused into this very narrow mouth to the small boat basin, and it accelerates those currents about threefold.
Wow. So it really, it's kind of like the perfect storm, literally, there for Crescent City. That's yes. Fascinating. I always wondered that, because it seems like every time there's been a big tsunami somewhere in the Pacific, Crescent City definitely feels the effects.
Usually on the West Coast, we're either number one or number two in terms of the largest amplitude.
Thanks for sharing your passion about the incredible tectonic setting of the North Coast and the history of the San Andreas Fault. It's quite fascinating. Thanks for joining us, Lori.
Well, thank you for inviting me.
Thanks again to our guest, Lori Dengler, Cal Poly Humboldt Professor Emeritus of Geology. You can learn more about the seismic hazards of the Northern California coast by visiting Cal Poly Humboldt Redwood Coast Tsunami Working Group's website at rctwg.humboldt.edu. Blue Dot is a production of North State Public Radio, a service of Cap Radio in beautiful and talented Northern California. We're distributed by PRX. If you want to revisit, share, or check out past episodes, you can do just that on our website, mynspr.org. And while you're at it, subscribe to our podcast so you never miss an episode on our website, the NPR One app, or wherever you get your podcast groove on. Our theme music, Big Wave Dave, is by Matt Schiltz. Blue Dot is engineered and produced by the maestro, Matt Fidler. For all of us here, I remind you there that from deep space, we all live on a pale blue dot.